Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Spoken Heart Radio. I'm Susan Dobie Chase, and today I would like to bring to your attention the amazing Phaedra Sheridan. Hi, Phaedra. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Susan?
I'm doing well, thank you. So we're both from the Upper Midwest, and it's time for the leaves to be changing. And have you been back to Minnesota recently?
Yeah, I actually am living in Minnesota right now. So,
oh, you are? That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. And I know you're doing restaurant work. Where are you at?
Say that again?
Where are you at? I know that you're working in a restaurant and that it's seasonal, so
oh.
It must be somewhere where tourists go.
Yes. I work at a tiki bar called Psycho Susie's. I bartend there.
Oh, nice. Very,
it has a huge patio on the river, so it's, very summer intensive place.
Yeah, and I bet that season is wrapping itself up now. What are you going to do when the season is done?
Sleep and have days off again, and get back to doing more creative stuff. I have I'm going on tour in just a few weeks to Omaha. I do a lot more art stuff when it's cold out.
That's great. That's
travel.
Really great. Well, Omaha will be lucky to have you. When are you going to be there?
Mid-November.
Mid-November. So you're in Omaha. Look for Phaedra. Phaedra, are you there?
I'm here.
Hear me?
Okay, now I can hear you. Before, you just sort of faded out, and so I wasn't able to hear you for a little bit there. I was just saying, if you're in Omaha and you're interested, make sure that you go and see Phaedra because it'll be fantastic. When are you going to be there?
November 8th through the 12th, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good deal. You want to promo any of the upcoming dates, or do you not have them right off the top of your head because it's still a while out?
Yeah, it's still a while out. I believe the 8th, so the 9th and 10th are when, the 9th I have a storytelling show, and the 11th I have a feature, but I'm not sure the details of them.
Okay. So just look for Phaedra's name if you're out there. And, it'll be very worthwhile to see her. She's very funny and profound all at the same time. Just wonderful work. Just wonderful. You'll get to hear it. In fact, what have you been up to lately? Have you been doing something else with your work or in life that you wanted to talk about briefly before we get into your poetry?
Well, we were just chatting ever so briefly before the show. I just finished a project with a local band here named Pancake 7, and they're on this project where they're working with different types of artists, different mediums, and spending some time rehearsing with them and having that artist be the feature in the band them often.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had my live show with them last night, which is very challenging for me because I tend to do a lot of comedy, which is difficult with music. You know, you really have to put a lot of effort into choreographing your timing with a band
when you do
humor.
Right.
But it was
right.
fun.
Because
otherwise
you're, as you said, dancing all over the punchline, that's the word I'm looking for.
Oh, yes,
and
they
so,
stomp on the punchlines a lot. Yes, and I was worried about that, but then I started saying, okay, here. I need my space here at this pause. But and it worked. It worked great. They were really fun to work with. They were really easy going, and all of them were very flexible. So it ends up being a really good show.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm really glad you had a good time with that. Would you be willing to, at this point, to read us one of your poems?
Sure. Last night, this guy played guitar on stage, and it made me think of you because you play guitar on stage. So I spent the next 15 minutes running a mental slideshow. Los Angeles, you give me half of your egg salad sandwich. Indianapolis, you grab me because the smell of gasoline on my fingers turns you on. Chicago, we play Ferris Bueller and follow a kids' tour group at the Institute of Arts. Ashland, you bowl five strikes in a row, etc., etc. I find this still happens a lot. Someone's wearing shoes, so I think of you because you wear shoes, you drink beverages, you breathe air. You can see how this might be a problem. Sometimes I just blurt your name out loud in my apartment for no reason, like a Tourette's outburst. And I'm supposed to write this poem about you because I keep saying I'm a poet, and I've been trying for the 3 years since you stopped bowling in my presence, but it keeps coming out like, I hate you, I hate you, I wish I'd never agreed to date you. But the day you left, the sun set for the last time, the trees wilted, and happy little creatures seek to scurry. Or my heart is a block of frozen, petrified, solid, really cold ice without you. Or I don't need you, never did. I can open my own pickle jaws, motherfucker. Oh, I can write volumes about every little one-night stand, pointless encounter, waste of saliva I've tried to replace you. But you're drying up the ink in all my favorite pens. You're hiding all my journals and shorting out my keyboard. You are the quintessential cock block. If I had a cock, you are the ultimate writer's block. Actually, that one works. The point is, I know you can eat a whole egg salad sandwich, but I appreciate the gesture. And that stretch of 90-94 from Chicago to Rockford has never been the same since I drove it home from the end of time. And when you stayed over this past spring, you slept on the couch, took a shower, and left. But it took me 3 days to take your towel out of the bathroom and five more to wash it. I find I can't really write about something till I have a little distance perspective, but you're still mashed up against me like a Siamese twin. And the kicker is, I can't even say I want you back. You were all shades of fiasco. I was only on your mind if I was waving my arms in front of you and having sex with you. I suspect you wouldn't have known the difference if I had been inflatable. And you only gave me the sandwich because you were being such an asshole. So if you asked, would I take you back? Yeah, I totally would. Mm-hmm. Yep, like that. And that pisses me off. But if I was with you right now, I'd be sitting in some hotel room getting my ass kicked at Scrabble or pitching a makeshift baseball game in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And my debt would be twice as ridiculous, and I'd weigh like 100 pounds because you supplement eating and sleeping, and not in any good way. But I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be running my stupid life. You are the rock star me I'm too impatient to wait for. And you got nothing to do with anything. Most of my friends don't even know what you look like, so you're all mine. And a terrible kisser. And a really sore loser. And I suspect you'll litter my life with unfinished pages about the empty spaces you left in my apartment for years to come. And tonight, when someone asks to borrow a guitar pick or uses the words and or the, I'll say to you, snapshot, something somewhere away from here and today. Not much I can really do about that. Just thought I'd mention it because it was on my mind.
Beautifully done. Just beautiful. Autobiographical, is this from your own life, a story that came from you to begin with?
Oh, yeah. Everything I write is autobiographical. I'm not good at making stuff up, so I just write about real stuff.
Yeah, and there's something so real, and every person can relate to in that vignette of ideas about this person who keeps coming into your mind for the silliest little reasons. I really love how you got to this point. What is your process like when you start working on a piece like this? Where does it begin, and what do you do to cull it so that it becomes this piece of humor and poetry all in one?
I mean, I don't really think about things in a non-humorous way, you know. I tend to be very hyperbolic and sarcastic just in sort of the way that, you know, my perception of the world, the way that I react to things. And so that sort of, you know, sometimes I have to beat it back a little bit. But I just tend to, you know, with a piece like this, which is, you know, sort of a longer performance, they tend to start with, I'm just very agitated about something. You know, like this specific piece, like, was actually inspired by, I was at a live show, and there was some, you know, indie dude with a guitar up there, and it made me think of this guy that I hadn't dated in, I don't know. I mean, it must have been like 4 or 5 years at this point. And I'm like, ah! So then I went home and I just started ranting at him in my head. And this is what came out of it. I tend to do a lot of, you know, with the longer performance pieces, I tend to just let them pour out of, you know, the pen. They just, it's just sort of a ramble. And then I trim them back.
Yeah. So you end up with a lot more material than what you need, and then you have to keep editing it into a smaller and smaller picture frame, is what you're saying, kind of?
Yes.
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 And I often find, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, hey, I already said that three different ways. Apparently, I really mean it. Let's figure out the most effective way to say it once, you know. And
right.
But the jokes,
right.
I don't really have, they just happen. Just a... you know, snarky person.
Did you come from a family that was snarky and humorous and always looking for laughs? Where did that come from?
I mean,
from
a little bit. I think, yes.
Yeah.
My family was definitely liked to laugh, but I think that sort of the best way to be effective at comedy is to have a really fucked up childhood, you know? Like, I came from alcoholism. And
okay.
the you know, the humor is a coping mechanism. It's a way to
yes.
process painful reality in a way that you can process it. You know, it's a more comfortable way to process pain. And so, you know, I came from a very drunk father and, you know, stuff like that. That then ended up making me just sort of, this is the way that I approach my life. Is through this filter, and that, I don't know, that's a good honing mechanism. I did a panel once on comedy at the National Poetry Slam with all of these heavy hitter comic poets, Robbie Q and Chappie and all these great funny gentlemen, and someone asked that question, how do you be funny? And I said, have a fucked up childhood. And I looked at the panel, I said, am I wrong? Is there anyone on this panel who didn't? And they're like, no, that's how that worked.
Wow.
True. Yes, like I can't teach that. That's just, I can help you like polish stuff. I can teach you how to have something horrible happen to you.
Well, you know, I guess that when you find that as a universal experience, that's really true, that sometimes the negative things in our life turn into some of the most positive, just like, you know, your best personality trait can also be your worst personality trait all in the same breath, pretty much. So, yeah, it's interesting, that whole dichotomy of life thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance. I mean, I think it's an awesome and effective tool. It's also a great way to convey information, you know, especially if it's rough information, you know. I mean, I've always been a fan of Michael Moore's his documentary technique. You know, it can be very heavy-handed, especially his later stuff, but he's got, you know, the way that he uses humor to get people to hear information that, you know, is it's difficult information, and it's a really great way to teach people stuff that they don't necessarily want to hear. It's painful to hear or look at, but with that comic filter, it makes it palatable, you know.
Exactly.
You can process it.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. And when I think of the people that you've mentioned, like Robbie Q and Chappie, I mean, I certainly see that in their work as well, you know. I mean, this piece for you was about trying to get over somebody that you just can't get over, and in a way, that's a sad thing, but you took it and you flipped it on its head so that it was easier to listen to and laugh at and find yourself going, yeah, I've been there. I understand that. In a way that just, you know, just telling the facts certainly would not get across.
Well, that's always, you know, the thing that got me writing, I mean, I've been writing my whole life, but the thing that got me sort of serious about it as an adult was a folk singer that I saw, actually, it's funny that I'm saying this, because the folk singer actually ended up being the guy that the song's about, but it was a folk singer that I saw at the Winnipeg Folk Festival. And his lyrics were just so unbelievably blunt and honest. And I couldn't believe that he would say out, like, some of the stuff, I couldn't believe he was saying it out loud. You know, I was like, people really think that, but I can't believe he just said that. And the honesty of that and the just the sort of courage to, you know, just blurt that kind of stuff out, that really attracted me. I mean, I guess it attracted me as an artist. I thought, you know, I'm really impressed by the effect that had on me, you know, and I want to have that kind of effect on people. And so I really like the idea of being incredibly honest. And I really like the idea of people seeing themselves and their own lives in my writing, you know. So
yes.
I try to just break down human experiences I have and, like, you know, make them very personal, but they don't necessarily have to be just so meticulously detailed that I've painted your imagination out of the picture, you know. Like,
yeah.
Because, you know, otherwise I could just write in journal and never show it to anyone, you know, but I like the idea of, I also like that sort of unifying human experience concept where it's like, you know, it doesn't matter what gender you are or what, you know, racial background or sexual orientation or, you know, we all have common experience, you know, we all have exes we don't get over, we all have, you know, the society, we have access to the same movies and TV shows and, you know, a lot of things about the culture are similar, and I like the idea of crossing what some people might see as a barrier between two people with something that is so visceral that it's like, oh my God, it was like you were talking in my head, you know?
Right. Yeah. Well, boys, I'm halfway through the show already, and I would love to hear another piece of your work if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. This one's not a performance-y piece. This one's one that I just published this past year, but it is called Binky Atop the Ideal Diner. It was me, Terry, my best friend Binky, and whatever guy she was dating at the time, I think it was Chad. On a nondescript summer evening, we loafed about our sleepy Midwestern college town where nothing ever happens around here. God. Someday we were all going to get the hell out of this place, but tonight we were 16 years old, and there was nothing to do. Chad, let's call him Chad, wanted to impress us all with his urban exploration skills, so he said, "Do you want to see something cool?" He took us around back of the Ideal Diner where they'd kicked us out for cramming 8 teenagers in a booth every day after school to split a single basket of fries and make a general nuisance of ourselves. It was really dark back there. The weed colony obscured a vast collection of furniture, skeletal remains, and unidentifiable rusty objects. Chad scaled a drainpipe on the back of the building like a monkey, or Spider-Man, or Evel Knievel, and we three girls looked at each other in doubt and trepidation and dare. I've never been too good with heights, but I've always considered myself macho. Binky, the girlfriend, had to go first. That's just how it was done. I followed her with false courage. Terry brought up the rear. At the top, Chad beckoned us to follow as he slid across a narrow ledge that ran along the brick wall that lined a seemingly bottomless courtyard that came between us and the rooftop where Chad now stood. He'd done it so fast, like a tightrope walker or a monkey. But we were teenage girls, not gymnasts, so we lined ourselves up holding hands, me in the middle, our backs to the wall, facing the bottomless courtyard from which grew an elm tree not 3 feet in front of us. We sidled along this tiny ledge just a few inches wide, our toes hanging over abyss, very, very slowly. There was nothing to hold on to but two hands. I pictured plunging into darkness onto rusty shapes or dining room chairs or whatever lay below. So that's what I did. I tipped, unable to stop, ever slowly forward, watching myself tumble to unknown. At the last moment before my feet lost their purchase, I grabbed the tree. There was no coming back from this, no reverse momentum I could imagine. I hung at a 45-degree angle from the wall, feet gripping the ledge, hands clutching feeble branches. Binky, who I'd inadvertently pulled along with me, hanging from my arm over the chasm. As I accepted that she would surely soon fall to her death, and I might be able to swing out to the tree, but I'd most likely fail, she said, "Hey, there's another ledge down here." It was not 12 inches below us, a good couple of feet wide. You could walk it leisurely facing forward, for Christ's sakes. She let go of my arm, just standing there, and I dropped down easily, death-faced and overcome. Chad, when challenged, admitted he knew about the other ledge, but that one's not as fun. When we reached him, I choked him to death. Or at least I pretended to. And we all looked out over the cornice of the ideal diner, two floors above the street at the cars below. There wasn't really much to do after that. We didn't stay up there long.
Interesting. Tell me about what's at the heart of that particular piece.
You know, that's just, I did a series of pieces this year that were just snippets of time, you know, just.
It feels like it's happening right there with you, you know, like I'm right there in every single moment with you. And when you're tipping forward onto that tree, I'm holding my breath as a reader or even as a listener, which makes it even more incredible. And I think that you have a real talent, not only for comic timing, but for the timing in general that allows people to be in that moment. And I think that's remarkable. I truly do.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I just, I got really fascinated. I'm obsessed, actually, with just snapshots, you know, snapshots of moments that
right.
I found interesting, you know. And it's mm-hmm. it happened. There's a girl named Binky, you know. There's a girl named Gary. I'm not sure it was Chad, but I think it was maybe Chad.
So this
but,
was a true story, and then you kind of went through and made it into something that had more punch.
I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
Like, that's pretty much what happened. But,
it
yeah,
really
I mean, I don't
cool.
know. I guess, yeah. Like,
and this is what you're talking about when you talk about storytelling, right? Because here's a great story that you just told. And when I asked you about it, it really was a true thing. So what you really are doing is telling stories that are poetry or telling jokes that are poetry. And you go all over between the different kind of lines for different genres in your work. And I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I also do, and I do actually storytelling as well, you know, I mean, like The Moth
mm-hmm.
and Snap Judgment and stuff like that. But, and that's a little different. I don't try and craft the language as much with those as just, you know, describe and tell. But
yeah.
I don't, you know, mess around with any sort of literary devices to make it sound it doesn't matter. They, I mean, you know, that's just, that's not something that they like in those shows. It's not, they're like, I don't need you to show off. I just want to hear what happened.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, yeah, we know you're a writer. Anyway, what happened? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, which is a different, you know, that's a whole different thing in itself, because you have to think of what details are going to grab your audience and
mm-hmm.
what's going to bore them, you know, like they're
yeah.
not like pare down on that and how to craft that story so that it's suspenseful and interesting and, you know, you don't give it all
did
away.
Did that come easily
too early
to you, or does that come more difficultly? I mean, do you enjoy doing the kind of writing where you have to hone it down, like you were saying, into the little snapshots? Or do you like the idea of telling the longer story?
I mean, as a writer, I
yes.
like doing the poetry more.
Okay.
The longer stories are not really... Those are live event type of things to be told in front of an audience. So, you know, I mean, when I'm writing those down, I'm literally paring them down to the size of time that show allows.
Yes.
And I don't feel as challenged as an actual artist, like putting
mm-hmm.
them together on the page. It's sort of
yeah.
a technical exercise, not an artistic, you know, stretching of talent. But you know, then I really like doing the shows, and the audiences tend to be gigantic
right.
at those shows, so it's a fun room. You can tell stories from your life and get great
yeah.
Energy off the audience and feedback, and I'm, you know, I come from the theater background. That's what my college degree is in, and so I really think that, to me, half of what I do is writing and half of it is stage work. And,
yes.
you know, I teach a lot of performance every year at the National Poetry Slam, every year that I go. I teach a daily performance workshop because I think that is just as important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is often overlooked. But so I enjoy the
I agree.
Different formats and rooms and genres of performance, because that stretches me as an artist and
yes.
teaches me things.
Yes.
So.
And do you want to, real quick, because we're going to have to get into your last piece if I'm not going to cut you off with it, I was hoping that, is there anything that you want to get to about the merchandise that you have, or anything, since you said that you just published this one fairly recently?
Yeah, you know, I don't, this is terrible, but my website is currently under construction, so
okay.
you can keep an eye out for it. I'm going to, you know, within the next couple of weeks, have it all fixed up, but you can follow me on, you know, on much more, be updated on shows and whatnot, and then, you know, within the next couple of weeks, ThedraSheridan.com should be back up and running, and keep
perfect.
Keep posted on where things are. But yeah,
Thedra, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to run out of time here, and so I wanted to make sure that I gave you time to get in your last piece. I really, really enjoy your work, and I it was wonderful talking to you today.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
At 3 o'clock in the morning, he's pounding on my door with a liter of gin in his bloodstream and $30 worth of White Castle hamburgers in case I'm hungry. This isn't as bad as when he belts Ricky Martin with feeling for his best friend who died in a mob-related incident I suspect is either not dead or never existed. I trust him so implicitly, I wrote down the serial numbers to all my stereo components before he moved in. But he's really cute. Listen, you want to spend your time registering for online dating services, signing up for Tinder, calling love lines, you do what you got to do. But I need a new boyfriend like I need to exfoliate with a cheese grater. My romantic history reads like John Bobbitt's diary. I cannot be trusted. You show me 50 handsome, responsible, upstanding men, and one selfless, loveless, self-absorbed creep, I'll take the creep. every time. I like them mean and inconsiderate. The kind of guy who hides guns in my hall closet. The kind of guy who lets me know it's over by bringing his new girlfriend home to spend the night while I'm visiting from out of town. Yeah, baby. Rest assured, if I'm into him, he's probably got a 3-year-old locked in his trunk. You say you want to fix me up with a nice guy? No thanks. I pick my lovers from a lineup. Find me the most despicable, compulsive, insensitive, fucked up asshole in any given room. That's my sweetie. Does this sound bitter? Well, I'll make a deal with you. Why don't you wait unwittingly in the car while your boyfriend steals $50,000 from the bank, then come talk to me about puppies and ice cream? I'm not saying that all men are assholes. I'm not. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm telling you is that I am a fucking moron. I bailed that guy out of jail. The White Castle guy. Idiot. Is it because I'm afraid of real commitment? Do I think bastards are more exciting? Am I looking for someone like my father who bought Mom a shotgun for Mother's Day? Who cares? Gentlemen, you want to take me out for a nice romantic dinner? Naked Arby's and I'll melt. Score extra points if you forgot your wallet at home. You buy me flowers, they better be plastic or dead. Chocolate, you're going to want to eat half of those before you get to my house. Forget my birthday and I will put out because no one ever won me over by being a nice guy. You want a piece of this action? You better be prepared to leave me stranded in a bar in Phoenix where the bathrooms are labeled poles and holes. I just can't control myself around a motherfucker. That's how it is. That's who I am. So fuck it. Forget it. You say smoking takes years off my life, I say that's just less boyfriends to rob my apartment while I'm at work. You say I'm going to end up a spinster? Well, I've already started collecting the cats. So while you jerks out there, set your crosshairs on another target. And if you need me to explain this to you, call me later. We'll discuss it over drink.
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much, Deidre. Next week, tune in
for
another wonderful spoken word artist. Until then, be kind to one another. This is Susan Dobie Chase. Until next week.